Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. Some Washington legislators are considering a plan to allow health insurance plans that don't meet the standards of the Affordable Care Act to be sold in the state. Democratic State Senator Andy Billig says that idea is a poor one.
A poor use of their funds to put money into a health plan that's not going to protect them when they get sick.
Steve Jackson reports on the progress of the proposal so far. Also on the show, the Astoria City Council held a goal-setting session on Monday. Out is the process for selling surplus or excess city properties, and in is a commitment to follow through on the plan to renovate the city's public library. That story coming up right after NPR News headlines next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Early each year, the Astoria City Council meets to set goals for the coming fiscal year. This year's session took place on Monday. While many of this year's goals are continued from last year's list, one notable change was the elimination of the city's plan to sell off surplus or excess properties. Increasing public opposition to the process emerged after the first properties came up for sale last October. Confusion over just how many properties would be sold, concerns over geologic stability of some of the properties, and the loss of forested areas were some of the concerns cited by citizens during public comment at city council meetings. Mayor Willis Van Duzen explained how the process will be wrapped up.
A year ago, we had a goal of selling excess city property. We have removed that goal. We're going to continue our negotiations with those people that we've had discussions with or offers. But any of the properties that have not been any negotiations or discussions will be taken off the area properties list and is no longer a city goal.
Interim City Manager Brett Estes listed the 16 goals the council will pursue for fiscal year 2014.
They are 16 goals, the first one being implement the library renovation plan, 2, involve community in developing the eastern half of Heritage Square, 3, support community efforts to provide emergency warming shelters. 4, develop plans for pedestrian and traffic safety on Williamsport Road. 5, continue working to complete landscape plans for the column. 6, continue implementation of the Riverfront Vision Plan. Number 7 is support community efforts to develop a dog park. Number 8 is complete emergency communication system. Number 9, develop an affordable housing survey working through community partners. Number 10, maintain advocacy for the Astoria Bypass, for fishery issues, and for business development and expansion through the Astoria Downtown Historic District Association Business Development Committee, Columbia Pacific Economic Development District, and Clatsop Economic Development Resources. Number 11 is continue enforcement of the derelict building ordinance. Number 12 is support implementation of CHIPS and all volunteer programs. Number 13, continue efforts to improve pedestrian safety. Number 14, continue support of diversity through the Clatsop County Historical Society, Astoria Warrenton Chamber of Commerce, and Lower Columbia Diversity Project. Number 15 is ensure maintenance plans are developed for all city projects. And number 16 is a goal, the language is yet to be determined, but for setting open houses for the city council and for the staff to be available for the community.
The council also identified other initiatives for the coming year, including an online budget report for citizens and monitoring the water rate assistance program. Community comment will be taken on the goals list before formal adoption by the city council, expected to happen in the next couple of months. Outstanding liens, vacant building fees, and nuisance abatement fees on the Flavell properties in Astoria have mounted to over $1 million. The properties include storefronts on Commercial Street and an abandoned residence on 15th Street. Tuesday night, the Astoria City Council approved additional liens on the properties to cover vacant building fees for 2013 and 2014 in the amount of $35,900. This is the second time the council has approved liens to cover the vacant building fees since the enactment of a derelict buildings ordinance in 2011. The ordinance has spurred property owners to clean up and repair dozens of properties around the city. City personnel did take nuisance abatement measures on the Flavelle residence at 15th and Franklin in 2012, but so far, current owner Mary Louise Flavelle has not paid the citations or undertaken efforts to bring the residence or other properties into compliance. City Attorney Blair Henningsgaard indicated that in order to move forward with the properties, they would have to move to the next step in the process.
At some point, the city will need to consider whether it wishes to enforce these liens, which will be done by a sheriff's sale.
To date, the only official communications from Flavelle have been through an attorney. Henningsgaard said there is some indication of movement on the Flavelle side to resolve the issues. He did not provide specifics or a timeline. The council unanimously approved the additional liens on the Flavelle properties. Retrenchment isn't a word you normally hear in everyday conversation, but it has a very specific meaning in the context of Oregon's state universities. And if a proposed retrenchment plan is adopted at Southern Oregon University, it will mean fewer programs and fewer teachers. From Jefferson Public Radio, Liam Moriarty explains.
Recently, on the campus of Southern Oregon University in Ashland, a small group of mourners dressed in black and carrying a plywood coffin approached the steps of the administration building. Standing near a banner declaring, "We mourn the programs lost to retrenchment," student Jamie Toma made a solemn announcement.
"Here is a list of those terminated. Let us remember them. Art history major. Art BFA. Business chemistry co-major."
After tolling the list of the deceased, Toma and the other mourners hoisted the coffin on their shoulders and the mock funeral proceeded around campus. Toma said the proposed program cuts would impact him directly.
"I am an art history major and a creative writing major and a French minor, all of which are proposed to be cut in this retrenchment."
SOU President Mary Cullinan triggered anxiety all across the campus last November when she announced the start of the retrenchment process. Cullinan said declining state support and sagging student enrollment made it necessary for the university to fall back and regroup. Cullinan says that over the past two decades, the state has dramatically stepped away from funding for higher education.
"We get millions of dollars less than we did only a few years ago, and we have 1,000 students more than we had a few years ago."
Cullinan says previous rounds of belt tightening leave SOU with no choice but to cut programs and faculty. Under the terms of the faculty's union contract, that kind of academic restructuring can only be done once retrenchment is declared. After making the declaration last fall, the administration developed a draft plan that recommends dropping programs that attract few students. Cullinan says most SOU students graduate in one of only five majors.
"And so you have these really large programs, and then you have these very tiny programs that are graduating one or two people a year. And truly, to be good stewards of the students' money, we have to be able to put our resources into the big programs."
Under the retrenchment proposal, majors in physics, art history, international studies, and more would be eliminated, as well as more than a dozen minors and other programs. Over 3 years, as many as 45 full-time faculty positions could be cut. Not surprisingly, students, community members, and especially faculty are alarmed at the proposal.
"They've certainly expressed that they're not happy about the situation."
Professor David Carter is chair of the Faculty Senate at SOU. He says his colleagues are concerned for more than just their own jobs.
"And I hear that from other faculty as well, saying we definitely want to save this department because of the value that it adds to a liberal arts education."
That concern led the Faculty Senate to vote recently to authorize a vote of no confidence in President Mary Cullinan and two other top SOU leaders. Carter stresses the move is not meant as retaliation for the retrenchment plan, but he says,
"There have been quite a few faculty members who have expressed concern for quite a while about the continual state of affairs that we are in at the university.
A no-confidence vote by the faculty would have no legal effect. Cullinan and other top university officials aren't subject to faculty recall. But Carter notes that in the several dozen cases he's aware of where similar votes were taken at other American universities and colleges, more than half of the time a no-confidence vote resulted in a leadership change. While SOU is the only public university in Oregon that's in retrenchment, similar budget strains are making themselves felt around the state. Diane Saunders with the Oregon University System says these crises can be traced to a dramatic shift in government support for higher education.
20 years ago, the state covered more than 70% of the costs of educating a student within the Oregon University System. Now the student pays more than 70, and the state is the one paying a much lower percentage of those costs.
Saunders says the state put $755 million into the system in 1999. Now, 15 years later, the funding is at the same level, but with 34,000 more students in the state's public universities. Saunders says that trend got a big boost from two events in the 1990s. The first was when the state took on major funding responsibilities for local public schools. Previously, local property taxes shouldered most of the costs of kindergarten through high school. Then, in 1994, voters passed the Measure 11 mandatory sentencing law, which caused prison costs to skyrocket.
And that's when we saw funding for higher education being less and less available and really having to compete with some very important other funding priorities for the state.
Saunders says there's reason for optimism. The legislature is increasing funding for Oregon State universities, and the painful rounds of belt tightening are making the system more efficient. But at SOU, where the conversation is about which degrees will no longer be available and which faculty members will no longer have jobs, a lot of people are having a hard time seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Still ahead, Oregon is the easiest state in which to get an exemption if you don't want your child to receive immunization vaccinations.
It should be a decision made between us and our child's doctor, not being influenced, you know, in a bully type style from the CDC or the state of Oregon.
Now the Oregon legislature has passed a law making it more difficult for parents to get an immunization exemption for their kids. Kristen Foden-Wenzel reports just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Cloudy today, showers this morning, then rain likely this afternoon. High temperatures in the mid-40s with west winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. The chance of precipitation 80% with rainfall amounts around a tenth of an inch. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a 40% chance of showers early this evening. Patchy fog after midnight with overnight lows around 40. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says our fast-moving front brings more showers today. The activity diminishes tonight with high pressure starting to build in, giving us some patchy morning fog into tomorrow morning. Otherwise, some clouds, some sun tomorrow, becoming partly sunny Saturday and mostly sunny Sunday. The models show more clouds moving in Sunday night with a slight chance of rain developing Monday and Tuesday. If the high pressure builds in strong enough, it would keep the rain offshore, leaving us dry a little longer. Highs continue around 45 to 50 with lows dropping into the upper 30s. In an effort to better protect children from diseases like measles, mumps, and rubella, Oregon legislators have passed a law making it more difficult for parents to get an immunization exemption for their kids. The law goes into effect next month, but as Kristen Foden-Wenzel reports, it probably won't be an issue for parents until the beginning of the new school year in September.
Last year, about 6 of every 100 Oregonian kindergartners got an immunization exemption for diseases like whooping cough, polio, diphtheria, and hepatitis. Portland pediatrician Dr. Jay Rosenblum says it was too easy for parents to get an exemption.
All they had to do was turn the form over and there was a box on the back, and if they just signed that, they could then exempt their child from standard vaccines. It was the easiest of any state, and there's been studies to show that there's a direct correlation between how easy you make it for parents to exempt and the likelihood that they will just withhold the vaccines. It's a matter of convenience.
Rosenblum and the Oregon Pediatric Society made this case to the legislature, and it changed the law. Parents now have two options. First, they can schedule a meeting with a healthcare practitioner to talk about the benefits and risks of immunizations.
The second option is to watch an online interactive educational module.
Stacy Deasis-Matthews is with the Oregon Immunization Program.
And print a certificate at the end of that, turn it into their child's school or childcare, and claim an exemption.
She understands that parents have concerns, but she says the new law is needed to fight disease.
Immunizations are one of the most important and effective ways that parents can protect their children and we can protect our communities as a whole.
Matthews says the video lasts about an hour and starts with an introduction about how immunizations work and what they are. Then she says it talks about the benefits and risks of each of 11 different diseases. The video isn't finished yet, but the Oregon Immunization Program gave you a few audio clips.
This e-module is based on information publicly available from the scientific literature, from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and from the Oregon Health Authority.
Matthews believes Oregon is the first state to use video to provide this kind of information, and she thinks it'll sway parents.
A couple of years ago, Washington passed a law that requires parents who are claiming a non-medical exemption to get education from a healthcare practitioner. And they saw their exemption rates decrease by about 25% a year or two after that law was passed.
But student nurse and mother of three, Emily Gonzalez, doesn't believe she's going to be swayed by the new requirement. Her six-year-old son, Noah, has been diagnosed with autism. He was immunized against hepatitis B when he was a newborn. She says she knows that any link between immunization and autism has been widely rejected by mainstream science, but she's still wary.
I don't think that it's like a single smoking gun factor. You know, we may never know for sure what contributed it to Noah.
She says for now she'll be getting exemptions for Noah and his two little sisters.
What we decide to do in the future is a decision that we will make, but it should be a decision made between us and our child's doctor, not being influenced, you know, in a bully type style from the CDC or the state of Oregon.
Gonzalez says her two daughters recently contracted whooping cough, but she says they weathered it fine. She says she treated them with antibiotics and kept them home from school for 3 weeks.
I feel like the CDC's job is to worry about the population as a whole. But my job is to worry about my child. And the CDC may feel that an adverse reaction to a vaccine is acceptable in a small amount of population, but it's not acceptable to me for my kids.
Portland pediatrician Dr. Paul Thomas isn't pleased with the new law either. He says he gives almost every vaccine to his patients, but on a different schedule from the CDC. That makes him think twice about signing the new exemption certificate because it requires he follow CDC recommendations. Thomas says for that reason, and because it can take a long time to educate a parent about all the different childhood immunizations, many physicians will refer parents to the video. And he's worried about the objectivity of that video.
The problem is we haven't seen this video yet, right? I'm pretty sure I will go over it with fine detail that it'll be very lacking in mentioning potential side effects.
Among the audio clip from the video was this warning about the hepatitis B vaccine.
Some mild problems have been reported, such as soreness at the site of the shot among one in every four people, and about one person in every 15 will get a temperature of 99.9 degrees or higher. Severe allergic reactions occur about once for every 1.1 million doses of hepatitis B vaccine administered.
Dr. Thomas says he's not anti-vaccination, but that the CDC vaccination schedule doesn't fit everyone. For example, the CDC recommends the first of a series of hepatitis B vaccines start at birth. But Thomas says the main ways hepatitis B is transferred is through sex and IV drug use, not something young children tend to get involved with. So why not wait a few years before starting the vaccine?
None of us are at risk as long as our moms don't have Hep B until we do those risk behaviors. Let's say teenager. So I definitely think the Hep B vaccine makes a lot of sense in the early preteen years, you know, early teen years before there's any likelihood of them becoming sexually active or IV drug use.
Across town, Jay Rosenblum, the doctor who lobbied for the new law, says hepatitis B is a serious disease that is transmitted in ways other than just HIV drug use, sex, or via an infected mother. For example, he says it can be transmitted when kids bite each other. He says delaying immunization or spreading the vaccines out leaves kids vulnerable.
You increase the number of visits, you increase the number of days that the kids get poked. If an infant gets two pokes or three pokes, they're irritable. If you give them one poke and then one poke and then one poke, that seems downright mean to me, but But if parents insist that that's how they want to do it, we'll do that to humor the parents, but it's not safer for the children.
In a statement, the CDC says chronic hepatitis B infections are more likely to occur in people infected as young children. It says the vaccination strategy is to eliminate the virus in the entire country, and that means universal vaccination of infants. The way the new law is written, childhood exemptions are grandfathered in. That means the law's main impact won't actually be felt until September, when a new crop of kindergartners enroll for their first school year. I'm Christian Fodenwenzel reporting.
Finally, efforts are underway in the Washington legislature to allow health insurance plans that don't meet Affordable Care Act standards to again be sold in Washington. Steve Jackson explains.
Many people in Washington state lost their health insurance policies when the Affordable Care Act went into effect in January. And while President Obama said states could opt to reinstate previous plans for those who lost them, Washington State did not take that option. The new plans offered under the ACA have helped many people, but some are feeling a financial pinch, according to independent insurance broker Gary Franke.
What I've been seeing is that the lower middle class are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act. The upper middle class, they can afford a $1,500 payment per month. But the hardest part is people that are just above the cutoff for the subsidies. You know, if there's a family of four making, $80,000 in Seattle, it's not a lot of money. And this family's increasing their premium by 62%.
Franke was testifying in a recent hearing in the Washington Senate Health Care Committee on Senate Bill 6464, which would allow health carriers to continue to offer certain individual or small group health plans in the market that do not meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act and allow out-of-state carriers to offer insurance products in Washington. Republican State Senator Michael Bumgarner supports the bill, saying he wants to see more options for state residents to get affordable coverage.
The way to do that is not to have a one-size-fits-all healthcare policy. I think the way to do that is allow more innovative and a wider choice of healthcare offerings. And part of that is to allow folks from out of state to offer insurance, just like people can offer insurance out of state for car or home or auto insurance. We should do the same thing with healthcare.
But Democratic Senator Andy Billig of Spokane says allowing policies to be sold in the state that don't meet the new ACA guidelines is more of a threat to consumers than some realize.
A poor use of their funds to put money into a health plan that's not going to protect them when they get sick. If you have a plan that doesn't provide prescription drug coverage and you get cancer, your medical insurance is basically useless.
There may be another problem when it comes to reinstating the previous policies sold in Washington or expecting those out-of-state policies to be sold at the same prices as they are offered in other states. Testifying at that same Senate Health Care Committee, Sidney Savara of the Association of Washington Healthcare Plans said any plans sold in Washington would reflect this state's pricing.
I'm not sure you could, in the end up buying the exact same policy because those products that were, say, priced for Idaho were priced for that environment with those mandates that apply in that state and with keeping in mind that those services would be provided by the hospitals, physicians, and so forth that are in that state. If you move that same policy to our state, you would be subject to the different pricing structure here. I'm not sure that some of those, all those savings would carry over.
That measure is passed out of the Senate Ways and Means Committee and will receive a hearing in the Rules Committee. I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
That is all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you join the show late, you can listen to a podcast of the show from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1. That's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thank you for listening today, and tune in next week on Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.